This is KPOO, San Francisco, 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, Healthful Living's radio show. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant, where our show is where we talk about the health of our people, the planet, and our community. So today we are going to have a guest on. Her name's Susan Piver, and she is a best-selling author. She's the author of The Hard Questions, 100 Essential Questions to Ask Before You Say I Do, and The Hard Questions for an Authentic Life. She's worked in the entertainment industry as a writer, producer, and marketing specialist, and is frequently featured in the media, including appearances on Oprah and The Today Show. She is the founder and creative director of Padma Media, producing special book packages for best-selling authors, and she lives in the Boston area. So let me see if I can get her on the phone today. She has a new book, The Hard Questions for Adult Children and Their Aging Parents. So let me see if I can get her. Susan, are you with us?
Yes, I'm right here.
Great. So it's so great to have you on today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
So I'd love to talk to you about your new book, and then if you don't mind, I'd love to ask you a couple questions about your book on questions to say when you're getting married, because I think it's so relevant to so many people.
That'd be great.
Okay, excellent. So firstly, before I even kind of jump into the book itself, you've written several books on really digging into these hard questions that people typically aren't comfortable answering, and I'm curious what your background is, what it is about you. Obviously, you have a, I don't know if a knack for this is the right word, but you know, I'm curious as to, have you always been this way? I could see you as a two-year-old going, why? So I'm wondering if you can just share a little of your background.
Yeah, I don't have a background in any profession that would lend one to believe I would write a book like this or any kind of training. I have always asked a lot of questions, and for whatever reason, just sort of wanted to know a real answer. I wasn't comfortable with answers unless I thought they were true, which made me a real pain to be around as a child and even now. So my main questions weren't like, why is the sky blue? It was, why are you doing that? Why are you acting the way you're acting? And why, when I say this, do you do that? And, I mean, it sounds so silly. I don't think I've ever told anyone this, but I started writing a psychology book when I was in the sixth grade.
Wow.
Because I had all these, you know, very insightful observations that I thought needed to be shared with the world. Anyway, so that's my background.
Well, you probably did have insightful information, because when you're six, you see through all of that superficial stuff, and it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to this very day, I must say.
So let's start with your newest book, The Hard Questions for Adult Children and Their Aging Parents, because this is obviously a topic that everybody has parents, and everybody's going to go through this eventually, and it is very difficult to ask a lot of these questions. So it's nice to have some guidance. I know I was reading through some of these questions, and I was thinking, oh, yeah, I should do that. I want to do that. You know, some of the more, I would say, fun ones are things around the family. Are there any specific stories or achievements or anything that you'd want to share, and things about photographs and labeling all the photographs and all of that? And even those, which to me are a lot more fun than a lot of the financial questions, still were very uncomfortable to me. The thought of digging into family members' private lives, while it seems so ridiculous and so silly that, of course, we should be able to ask these questions, but I don't really, you know, I don't know if am I alone in here in the in this being uncomfortable, or what's the general feedback or that you get from people when these types of issues are approached?
Yeah, it's uncomfortable for everybody. There, you know, pretty much on both sides of the equation. When I was writing it, I thought that my parents would be uncomfortable about it, and I would have to lead the way, but it was actually the opposite. They were more comfortable. So, you know, it could be the parents that want to have the conversation and the kids don't, or vice versa. But the reason it is so hard for everyone, even if people are brave and sit down and say, let's do this, it's still hard and uncomfortable because we have to think that we're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for whatever reason, the only thing we know for sure is going to happen is the thing we want to speak about the least.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a difficult formula. And because that is the formula, for very understandable reasons, we miss opportunities to connect because we're too afraid or uncomfortable to talk about things that could make us feel closer or give us information or not confront in an aggressive sense, but to confront in a real open sense your real feelings and what the people in your life might need from you. You know, I wrote this book because my parents are, you know, they're old, but they're healthy, you know, knock on wood. And I realized that when I started to lose one or both of them, I actually might have withdrawn my heart a little bit from them or stopped because it would be too painful.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I would shift into like an administrative mode and just start making phone calls and taking care of details, which is fine, but not if it's a way to avoid being with them.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would have just, you know, seen their number on my caller ID screen and, you know, felt like, oh, God. I didn't want to do that. I did not want to back away from them at the time when they probably would need my love the most.
Mm-hmm. And after you went through these questions, what was your experience?
Oh, it was great. It was really great. And I'm fortunate my parents wanted to talk about, they were open. They said, yes, let's have this conversation. And it was very sweet, I have to say. It was uncomfortable. It was painful. I saw what my parents felt they had done well in their lives and felt they had done poorly. And that was good to know. It was very touched me very much in both cases. And it was actually very funny in some ways. We told crazy stories, and, you know, when my mother said, I would really like you children around my deathbed, my dad said, I don't care about you children. I'd like Miss Florida with me for my last moments. And, you know, it wasn't all like crying and smearing ourselves with ashes, although it was deep.
Mm-hmm.
So deep includes everything, you know, happy and sad.
I would imagine that it was quite healing as well.
It really was, and it gave everybody a sense of confidence. You know, no one knows how they're going to die or when, or it's completely unknown. But I think my parents now feel confident that we know their wishes. And, you know, we all got this big shock from the horrible Terri Schiavo situation of 6 or 8 months ago, and nobody wants to think that could happen to them. And when you have a conversation like this, you can feel at least more confident that it's not. Because the fact is, unless we make these decisions for ourselves and make them clearly known, other people will make them for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be in that position, and I didn't want my parents to be in that position. And I also didn't want to have to be guessing and wondering what they wanted on these extremely important things. And especially when I could know by just asking them.
Right. How do you recommend, well, let me go into a few of the questions here, and then I'll get kind of a little bit more detailed into the process. So I want to ask you both what the hardest questions as well as what some of the most important questions are. So let's start with some of the hardest questions.
The hardest ones are usually about money. But it really depends on your family, because for some families, the hardest ones are the ones that to you and I seem the most fun. You know, the relationship question.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about growing up? And are there, you know, how do you feel about, you know, do you have ambitions for me that you'd like me to know about? And, you know, whatever it is you might want to talk about the past and the present. For some people, those are really the hardest, and they go to the money ones and the do you have a will and do you have a living will? And that's taking care of business, and they have no problem with it. Other people are the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So each one of us probably has a sense of where our family falls on that spectrum. And it's good to start at the easy end.
And what about some of the most important questions?
The most important questions, setting aside, you know, psychological and spiritual things, is do you have a will? Do you have a living will? Who would you like to make decisions for you if you were unable to make them for yourself? And have you assigned a healthcare proxy? And the healthcare proxy is really important. That's the person who you have assigned in some formal way to make decisions for you. Because even if you have a living will and you've had lots of conversations with your children or spouse or whatever about your wishes, about living with pain or prolonging life under various circumstances, things get very complicated in such situations, and a living will can't, like, jump up out of a drawer and start, you know, rolling with the punches. But a healthcare proxy can be there in real time to make difficult calls on your behalf. And you might want your child or your spouse to be your healthcare proxy, but you might not. You know, they might be too close, or you may not feel confident in them. It's just important to choose someone who you feel can know your mind better.
Yeah, that's a hard one for me because I have very, very, being a nutrition consultant and in the alternative healthcare world, I have very specific beliefs about how I feel about certain parts of the medical system. And so I think either people would love to have me or hate to have me as the proxy person. But, you know, I think it's also difficult that if they didn't choose me, then I have to sit around and watch things that I highly disagree with. Boy, is there, I don't even know if I have a question regarding that. Do you have any comments about that?
Yeah. This is the time to put the other person first and to really work with delineating between what you would want for them and what they would want for them, or what you would want for yourself must be what they would want for themselves. So it's really an exercise. You know, if compassion is putting another before yourself, well, this is a compassionate endeavor. And you have to do what they would want, even if you think it's wrong, because this is their life.
Exactly.
And death. And a person, you know, each of us should have the dignity to go in the way we choose. And I'm not getting into legal things, but just the basic things, the way most of us die, we should have the dignity and, you know, grace of what our choices are.
That's a great point. And of course, I'm thinking of course, some things more like, should they give this medication or that one? You know, not necessarily so much about when somebody's on their deathbed. But that's a good point because I did hear a story one time about some people on the radio, and I don't remember all the details, but I just remember this person had very specific religious beliefs, and the other person that died wanted something a specific way, and the person with the religious beliefs didn't abide by what the person wanted, and I remember feeling so upset about that.
That makes me so upset, too.
Yeah.
Of course, you want to take care of the person, and most of us think taking care of means doing what we think is right, and we can't, you know, we take an ethical stand, and this is right, so it is right, but, you know, it's not that way. People obviously have different ideas about what's right, and it's great to learn what those ideas are, not so that you can debate them or choose them, but so that you can love them.
Mm-hmm. So, give me a sense of the process, because I'm reading through this book and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I should do this. And then, you know, I have to be honest that my family's probably the furthest from open, intimate, embracing. Not that they're not loving, but they are very uncomfortable with intimate questions. So I'm reading this going, yeah, I want to do it. And then I'm thinking, how am I going to approach it? And I thought, well, I could email her the questions ahead of time.
That's a good idea, actually.
Okay.
You know, that's a really good idea. It doesn't have to be a conversation where nobody wants to say yes to the invitation. Hey, let's sit down and cover 100 questions about your death.
Right.
Nobody wants to do that. But, you know, I saw this on TV, or a friend of mine just had this experience with their parents, and it really made me start thinking about us, and I think I learned that there are things that are important to know, and I'd love to talk about them with you. But if you don't want to or feel uncomfortable, if you could just write your answers down, and you don't even have to tell me what they are, but put them in a drawer somewhere, then I'll know where to get them if I ever need them. And that way the person can keep their privacy. They can tell you exactly what they want without questions. And, you know, that's not a bad way.
Well, that gives hope to the rest of us that maybe have challenges with that.
Even if you can only ask one question, you've still done great.
Yeah. Well, I think that, like you said at the beginning, you were thinking that your parents were going to be more uncomfortable about it, and it ended up being the opposite. I think a lot of times we have this fear that it's going to be a lot worse or a lot harder than it actually is when we get down to it.
I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And what I think everyone can understand, because everyone has lost someone. Most, you know, it's rare that someone hasn't lost their parents by the time they're ready to die. And we've all seen how confusing it is for the people who are left, and how the unresolved emotions or whatever they might be just sort of begin to attach to the stuff or the funeral or, you know, all these things that they really shouldn't be attached to. And it creates more pain if you don't separate them and try to relate to them before someone's gone. If you displace everything onto the stuff, which is the most usual, then it's awful. It's terrible.
Yeah. And I would think that if there's unresolved conversations or things in there, then the easy thing to attach onto is just, either, you know, it's kind of just like, let's just get this over with, and maybe not the best decisions are made for the person or for the family in that moment, but the whole concept is so painful, and they haven't wanted to go there for so long that it's just kind of like, let's get this taken care of.
Right.
So another question I have about approaching it is, yeah, how do spouses fit into this? So some people may be more financially inclined than others, and maybe they want to have their spouse there, or for whatever reason, they may feel more comfortable having the spouse there. Is that because the spouse obviously isn't a direct family member? Is that, I'm assuming obviously it's a case by case, a family by family basis, but any general sense of how that works better?
Well, yeah, you're right. It is case by case. If there's any chance that, if there are siblings, and if there's any chance that they can talk about this first between themselves only, I think that's a good idea. And there are questions in the book for siblings to ask each other before they even go ahead with the process if they just end up deciding to. But, you know, so I talked about it with my siblings. I have a brother and a sister, and we decided we wanted to do this just us with our parents, and that worked for everybody. I don't think our spouses wanted to be there, and you know, it was, and we didn't, we all felt the most comfortable this way, so that was lucky. And then you know, but other people obviously will feel different, and it's also extremely likely that one sibling will want to and the others won't, or all the siblings will, but they have 9 half siblings and 3 step siblings and 8 parents, and, you know, it can get extremely complicated. So it's good to give some thought in advance to your particular family circumstances and make a strategy for having these dialogues that is the most inclusive without being intrusive.
Mm-hmm. And what happens in that case when there's a, let's say there's 3 kids and 2 of them want to and 1 of them don't. Obviously, 2 of them could do it and the 3rd one doesn't have to participate. But, I guess, what do you do when everybody's not on board together?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it would be great if everyone would want to do this. And if 2 siblings do and 1 doesn't, and they say, I'm absolutely so angry if you do this, you know, you just have to make a call. I would probably do it anyway, and I would say, I'm doing it, and I want you to, but just be honest. I'm still going to do it. I think it's important. and I'll tell you what I find out if you want to know, and I won't tell you if you don't want to know. And, you know, we each have our own principles, and if we're in agreement, that's great, and if we're not, then we have some complicated choices to make.
Mm-hmm.
It's more complicated when there are step-siblings and half-siblings.
And,
you know, if you've been together in the same house since everybody was under 10 years old, you may not be an issue. But if you, because you feel like one family anyway, perhaps. But if your parents remarried when you were grown up, and you have step siblings who you've only known for a few years or something, then it's a different situation. Still, your parents' stuff is mixed together, but it might not be a conversation. You know, it's most likely that if my mother was married to someone else, my stepfather, that I would still just want to have the conversation with my mother, unless she felt differently.
Mm-hmm. So what do people do if, I mean, is the process similar if one parent wants to and one doesn't? I mean, I guess we just have to take this talk, just be open and talk about it and see who's willing to participate and see how it ends up working out?
Yeah, exactly. And if a good way to enter the dialogue is just, you know, just to point to, again, poor little Terry Schiavo, because we all saw that, and we all saw how horrible that was, and everybody who saw it thought to themselves, I do not want that to happen to me or anyone I care about. So you can, and this issue entered our national dialogue around that time. So you can say, I saw this, we saw this, and I've been thinking, I really don't want that to happen to you. I don't want you to be in that position. If there's anything you want me to know, let's sit down and talk about it.
What about questions for children? So, you know, what if I know several poor parents who lost their children, and nobody ever wants to ask children. I mean, and these children are 30, 40. How are there questions to ask them?
Yeah, they're pretty much the same. I mean, on this score, in the sense that everybody over 18 should say, I have or I don't want to have a living will, and I have assigned a health care proxy, or I've at least told someone what my wishes are, because, you know, anyone can just walk outside and get hit by a truck, obviously. And if you're over 18, you have the right to make decisions, to express your preferences and have those be the basis for decisions that are made for you. So everyone should, not everyone's going to, obviously, but everyone should make those things known.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm trying to think. I definitely want to ask about the wedding questions as well, but tell me, is there anything else here as far as the adult questions, any last things that you want to talk to mention to people so that they'll know in this whole process?
I would just say, you know, take a chance. Step out and at least try to do this. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, something good will result if your intention is to create a caring situation for this person, whether you actually care about them or not. Because a lot of people don't love their parents, some do, or they're angry or they're not angry or whatever. But if your intention is to put that other person's wishes up on your radar screen, something good will happen in the conversation.
Hmm. I'm sure you've had people write to you about their experiences doing this. Do you have any stories that stand out about this process?
Well, I've heard some really wonderful things, mainly along the lines that people had been tiptoeing around this conversation, either the children or the parents, but nobody knew quite how to go about it. And the book became a really good excuse, you know, for people. I was reading this, and it may be crazy, but let's look at it together. Or, you know, it sort of gave an objective system, as it were, for having this conversation, because it can be scary and emotional, and unless you have a sort of an order of steps, it makes it even more confusing. So, you know, I've had mothers say, I've been trying to talk to my daughter for 30 years about this, and this helped me do that, or, you know, I talked about this with my parents, and it just happened to be 1 week before, you know, something bad happened to them, and it was, I'm so glad I had this, and blah, blah. It's rare that a person would regret knowing the answers to these questions.
That's a good point, because when we, often when we're grieving somebody's death, the question or the thing that most so frequently comes up is, I wish I had just told them such and such, or, you know, had some dialogue.
You're so right. And how many people have we known, even us, who, you know, woke up one morning and started crying, saying, I wish I would have told them this. I wish I would have asked them this. And you can't.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to be one of those persons, one of those people. So I tried to ask what I thought was appropriate and sane to ask.
Yeah, and I definitely love your point about kind of making the book the excuse, or however you want to phrase that, oh, well, I didn't create these very intimate, uncomfortable questions. Somebody else did. Should we talk about this one and this one? And if they don't want to talk about it, they don't have to. But instead of, then it doesn't seem so personal. Like, why would you come up with that question? What are you trying to get at? And they're already here, and it's almost a kind of a good excuse that we didn't create the questions.
Exactly. You can triangulate situations. So you sit in a chair, and they sit in a chair, and the book sits in a chair.
Right.
Everybody can yell at the book.
Exactly. Well, this is really incredible. We are speaking with Susan Piver, the author of The Hard Questions for Adult Children and Their Aging Parents. This is KPOO San Francisco. You're listening to Reality Sandwich, Healthful Living's radio show. And we, as I mentioned, are speaking with Susan, and I would love to talk to you about your second book, or your actually the book that came before that one.
I'd love to. That's my favorite subject.
You know, it's the hard questions essential to ask before saying I do. So all of those great wedding questions that people are always uncomfortable asking. And, you know, how many times have we heard, oh, well, you know, some people, and I have no, I'm not passing judgment, but how many times I've heard, oh, well, you know, they kind of talked about the kid thing, but not really. And it turns out that he or she wanted something different. And then they end up getting divorced over it. So they might, I love, and you ask in the children section, do you want children? And then the second question is when? Because that's a really important question.
Yeah, I've talked to people that, and you know, again, you assume that what you want is what the other person wants, mm-hmm. because it seems so obvious to you.
Right.
You get married, you have children. So I've talked to people who, you know, they want to start having children right away, and they don't know that their spouse does, that their fiancé doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the thing about these questions, and I guess the reason to even ask them, because, you know, you love someone, and what more do you need to know? And in one sense, that's true. But a marriage and a love affair are different, two different things. And most, you know, really good, important relationships, when they fail, they don't fail because you don't love each other anymore. They fail because you've been unable to create a life together that you love. Because eventually the love needs to manifest in certain, you know, ways, as in your home and as you celebrate holidays and where you go on vacations and what have you. Those are not just things. Those are manifestations of your relationship. And, you know, we ask more questions about a potential job than we do about this, you know, hopefully lifetime relationship. And I can guarantee, without a doubt, that every single one of the questions in this book are going to come up anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So best to ask them in a peacetime than to have them come up, you know, as a weapon thrown at someone's head.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the way, you get so much closer when you ask these questions. I mean, it was a very intimate experience for my boyfriend and I, now my husband. It wasn't just like a checklist, it turned out. It was a way to know each other beyond our love affair. And I really learned a lot about his values, his vision, his fears, you know, so that when I said I do,
mm-hmm.
I knew who I was saying it to.
Mm-hmm. you know, do you know why we don't ask these questions? I'm guessing that it's similar in some respects to the adult questions in that we're it's intimate or it's scary or we're afraid to know the answer. Anything that differs for the wedding questions?
Well, they're both uncomfortable in a way, but they're uncomfortable for different reasons, I think, and to different degrees. But we're too afraid to ask these questions because, oh, God, we want to be loved so much and want to give love. And if you get in the ballpark of a relationship and you really want to be in a relationship, most of us just sort of close our eyes and hope for the best. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to challenge things too much or maybe say things that will make the other person not like us. And we all have things that we're convinced if someone knew about us, they would stop liking us. And asking questions like this is putting all that on the table. And not in an aggressive or, you know, mean way, but just a curious way. And then you know when you've asked questions like this, if you think you want to be in a relationship with this person for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to just sort of not confront that until it confronts you. And then much pain ensues.
Mm-hmm. Well, the great thing about this book is, what are the top two reasons that people argue with? It's sex and money?
I would put money first, for sure.
Yeah, sure. And so definitely there's great questions in both of those areas. And I suppose if you have children, you would probably put children as number three, I would guess.
Yeah, and there's questions also about work, because and community and religion and, you know, because for some people religion comes first and,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're likely to marry someone of the same faith, but most of us are not likely to marry someone of the same faith. And or many of us. And so even a question like what holidays will we celebrate, that can be a really important question that when the time comes and we don't have a Christmas tree, you start crying, and I don't even know what you're crying about, and, you know, let's talk about it now.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a big deal. It's not the tree, obviously. It's the vision of what a shared life looks like and what love feels like.
Mm-hmm.
In a real way. And these questions help you know that about the other person.
Definitely. You know, I think that a lot of times two people might ask the basic question. So if you say, you know, your topics of money and children and home and work and sex, we could probably come up with top one or two questions, and maybe a lot of us have asked those questions, but then it gets into not only do you want to have children, how many and when, but things like, well, do we want to breastfeed our baby? Do we want to vaccinate our baby? How are we going to discipline our child? And those, I mean, I've seen it firsthand from people that I know and stories that those questions, because this child is the person you love the most in the whole world, and to now have these two opposing views on how to handle it can be really difficult, not only for the parents, but also for the child. And I think those are questions that most people rarely think about.
Yeah, well, certainly not when you're out on your second date. But if you're thinking about, you know, maybe I want to be with this person, or we have already said we want to, you know, try to make this work for the long haul, you know, maybe those questions about children aren't that important to you guys because you're 20 years old and you're not going to have children for 20 years, or you're 60 years old and you're not going to have any more children. But if you think you are, it's good to ask these kinds of questions, not so that you can engrave some answers in stone and then pull out the book and wave it in the person's face when they do something different, but so that you can know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And of this sort of secret is that every single one of the answers is going to probably change.
Right.
So it's not the answers that are the thing we're going for. It's the, can we talk about these things? And can we know each other? That's the thing we're going for. And if you're thinking of marrying someone or committing to someone who doesn't want to talk about these things with you, that would raise a lot of red flags in my mind. You're going to have to talk about them at some point.
Right. And, you know, also my personal experience is that people change so much. I mean, we all change so much, even in 5 years or 10 years. Things that were not even, that I didn't even know about when I met my husband, are paths that we're both very heavily headed down right now. And part of me says, thank goodness I picked a good one. But also, I'm sure, because I know that we ask a lot of questions and talk a lot, that on some intuitive level, we knew that it doesn't really matter the answers to every specific question. It just matters the process that the two of you are willing to engage in. And this book helps to see if both people are in that same process together.
Yeah. Can you ride the waves of daily life? And can you hold conflict and disagreement within your relationship instead of having that force you into two separate camps? Can your relationship contain love and disagreement and not knowing? Because everybody has all three of those.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I definitely highly recommend both of these books. The nice thing about them is they're small. They, you know, you could read them in a short period of time, and most of it's questions. But there's some really good background on, you know, how to set up the conversation and all of that ahead of time. But it's great because, you know, it's almost like a reference book. You can just sort of pull it out and very easily, you know, see what questions are being suggested, spark some more questions for yourself. There's spaces that you can write in the book so that you can write down answers or tailor other questions. So it's almost like a little workbook.
Exactly, yeah. And there are no answers in there, by the way. I've had people who thought the answers were in the back, but they're not.
Oh, that's funny. So the two books that we're speaking of today are The Hard Questions for Adult Children and Their Aging Parents and The Hard Questions, 100 Essential Questions to Ask Before You Say I Do. And we're speaking with Susan Piver. And anything else that you want to say before we finish? I know I definitely want to give you time at the end to give your contact information so people can get a hold of you. I'm assuming your books are available on Amazon.
They are, God willing. And, yeah, I love to hear other people's questions. And if anybody would like to email me or something, the questions they think are important to ask of their parents or of their boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever, I'm really curious and interested in those things.
Hmm. Great. Well, Susan, thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you.
And how can people get a hold of you?
I have a website called thehardquestionsplural.com, and my email is susan@thehardquestions.com, and that's the best way.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so we are going to take a short break here, and then I am actually going to have if any of you have heard past shows, I'm going to have Jane Hersey, who is the National Director of the Fine Gold Association. We're going to have her talk about Halloween candy and the additives in candy and what parents should be aware of, not suggesting that we don't allow our children to participate, but just things to be aware of. So I am going to take a commercial break here, or a music break, actually, no commercials, and then we're going to come back and get Jane on. So stay tuned. This is KPOO San Francisco. You're listening to Reality Sandwich. This is KPOO San Francisco. We are back. Well, I had a little bit of challenge with the music there, so I apologize for that. But I have Jane on the line. And Jane, are you there?
Yes, I sure am.
Oh, great. So Jane is the National Director of the Fine Gold Association, and we've had her on before. They are, boy, how do we explain you in a nutshell?
Oh, I tell you, well, we show people how to find out if certain synthetic food additives are triggering a whole range of problems. That's kind of the main thing that we do. And we also guide people toward the healthier foods that they can find in their local stores.
Great. And today we have Jane on because she's going to talk about Halloween and Halloween candy and how to what to be aware of and maybe how to make better or healthier decisions.
Right, and how the children and the adults, for that matter, can have a good time and even have their candy if they want, but there's some candies that are better than others. And we have lots of, actually 30 years of experience on the part of many resourceful parents. So we've come up with some pretty good ideas, whether you want your child to have candy or to have other things instead. There are all kinds of options that you can use. Should I mention a few of those now?
Sure.
Okay. One is don't send them out hungry. It's like when you go to the supermarket and you're hungry, you know you come back with many, many more things. So feed the kids first before you send them out. Many parents will offer to swap, let the kids go trick-or-treating, and then when they come home, offer to swap the Junko candy for the more healthy candy, the more natural candy, without artificial colors, artificial flavors, and synthetic preservatives like synthetic sweeteners. So the second one is that you can swap good candy for whatever it is they bring home. And, of course, the always popular buyout. I used to buy the candy back from my children after they went trick-or-treating, and they really liked the money more than the candy, so that was always very popular. some people will go to a toy store with the child before Halloween, and they'll pick out a really desirable toy, and then mom says, well, I'm buying the toy, and the toy is mine, but when you come back from trick-or-treating, we can do a swap, and they do that. And, of course, when you take the bag of candies that are not okay, it's a good idea to have some of the many natural candies around, and they are so delicious that you're not going to miss the junky stuff. So swapping a toy is a good way. For a younger child, what some parents do is suggest that they leave their Halloween stash outside the door, and they tell them that the Halloween witch will come by, or the great big pumpkin, if you like. And the Halloween witch comes by and picks up the candy and leaves some toys in its place. All of those things are good. And, of course, you can give out trinkets instead of giving out candy. In fact, I just read about a study from Yale University where last Halloween they offered children either little gimmicks, toys, trinkets, things like that, or candy. And the two seem to be pretty comparable in desirability. And they offered the children the choice between the candy or the little toys. And about half of them chose the candy and the other half chose the toys. So the notion that these children will be upset if they don't have their sugar high really isn't. It's an adult presumption.
Very good point.
Yeah. So there are a lot of things you can do, and if you want to give out more natural candies, what I'll be giving out this Halloween is a little inexpensive candy called Pearson's Mint Patties, and they're found in discount stores, supermarkets, and they're little chocolate-covered mint patties that are individually wrapped. That makes a good choice, but you can also give out little trinkets or balloons or things like that. So it doesn't have to be just about candy.
Very, very good point. And I think that after a while, kids, especially if you start them out younger, they're not going to be expecting the candy as much as, you know, if they're 13 or something.
Right. And, you know, it would be one thing if they only got all of this candy a couple times a year. Many, many years ago, back in the 50s, 40s and all, children would get an overdose of candy a couple times a year. But now that they are getting it everywhere, teachers are handing it out right and left, and everywhere you go, people are feeding children junk food. And let's not even talk about what they're feeding them in the school cafeteria, which is atrocious in most schools.
Right.
So it's not a once-in-a-while thing anymore. For many children, what used to be an occasional thing is an everyday. It's what they eat all the time. And when you feed a lot of foodless food to little kids, you're going to see problems.
Mm-hmm.
The problems could be behavioral reaction. People know what kids are like the day after Halloween. I noticed that when my kids were in school, they always managed to have a teacher's work day on the day after Halloween. And I always wondered about that. They can... these, not the sugar so much, but the artificial colors, flavors, and those things can affect the way they behave. It can affect their ability to focus. We have children who would reverse their handwriting
mm-hmm.
when they were exposed to these additives.
It's almost amazing that they can even do it. It's like upside down and backwards. It's fascinating.
You know what's really weird about it, Julie, is when the child is reacting to these artificial additives, to the colors, flavors, and all, they do not see that their handwriting is backwards.
Wow.
And that kind of makes you worry.
Yeah.
So what Feingold does is we show people how you can find the foods you like. You don't have to give up the foods you like, but there are alternative foods. For example, you can buy a macaroni and cheese mix with yellow number 5 and yellow number 6, which are petroleum-based dyes, or you can buy the almost identical product from the same company without the yellow dyes. It's really that simple. You can go in the supermarket and you can find cake mixes that are natural. You can find convenience foods, frozen waffles, cookies, soda. It's all out there. And nobody has to eat synthetic colors, flavors, and preservatives. Most of these are petrochemicals. Most of them are made from crude oil.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, do they have a powerful effect, particularly on children.
Absolutely. What are some of the natural candies that parents might want to stock up on?
Well, there are some of the most delicious of them you would have to mail order. And one of our members has a candy store in Delaware, and she sells all natural candies. And her website is the three W's, then squirrels-nest.com. That's squirrels-nest.com. And they can get much more information at our website as well about natural treats. And that is ADDDiet.com. And the great news is that many, many supermarkets, as well, of course, as health food stores, have a wonderful collection of candies. I live in a fairly small town, and I can go to my neighborhood supermarket and buy all-natural jelly beans and gummy bears. I can even buy them by the pound. It's just amazing. Supermarkets, particularly the newer ones, have a wonderful selection now of natural treats. So whatever it is you want, whether it's chocolate or even marshmallows, you can mail order marshmallows if you can't find them locally. Jelly beans, gummy bears, you name it. Candy canes, M&M type candies, chocolate lollipops. Now, we're not saying you should OD on candies, of course, but, you don't have to deprive yourself. It's just a matter of, instead of the chocolate chips with the fake vanilla, which is vanillin, buy the chocolate chips with the pure vanilla extract.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they actually cost less.
And certainly taste a lot better, too.
Oh, boy. Absolutely.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you, Julie.
And people can reach you at ADDDiet.com.
ADDDiet.com or 1-800-321-3287.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've been listening to Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. Our website is www.healthfullivingsf.com. That's Healthful, HealthfulLivingsf, as in San Francisco, .com. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned every Thursday at noon for Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth on the health of our planet, community, and people. Thanks for listening.